So that new housing brought into the market is not about lower and middle. New housing brought in, unless it's government subsidized, new housing is about that top 10% of the income categories. The reason I identify that is because, yes, families are making choices. They're trying to find the way to balance. But the way they're finding to balance is the way I actually started this talk. They drive till they qualify. And that means they start at wherever they work, and then they just start drawing concentric circles and driving in every direction until they get 45 minutes away from work, and then they can afford it, an hour away from work, an hour and a quarter away from work, 2 hours away from work. That's how families have made the balance to try to find affordable housing, houses that they can stay in. So my sense here is that for the typical parent who is very concerned about school quality, neighborhood quality, that the idea of making a trade-off here, many of them, particularly in the high price corridor, you know, the east and coast, the coastal cities, feel like they don't have any option. And let me just underscore that with one more little government statistic, and that is when you disaggregate the data and look at the change in housing prices for families with no children and families with children, housing prices over, we only have the data back to the 80s for this, that the government's collected the data in this particular way, but the rate of increase for families with children has been more than double that of households that have no children. In other words, in my view, the key trade-off that we're talking about here is not how many dollars in the wallet. That becomes the constraint. The key trade-off is how far I'm going to have to commute in order to get my children into a school district that I want at a price that I can get enough nickels together to be able to afford.
I have a different interpretation of the data. I think the rise in mortgage costs is principally due to the rise in home ownership. The home ownership rate has risen from 64% to a peak of 70. It's now back down to 69. And that's a housing choice. These are households who've decided to increase the amount of housing services that they're consuming. They've gone from renting homes to owning a single family home. The principal reason for that increase is this conscious decision to consume more housing.
Actually, Mark, my data are comparing homeowners to homeowners. So we're talking about how much people are laying out in mortgages. So the percentage of people who have mortgages doesn't alter the data here. It's how much homeowners are spending on their mortgages in inflation-adjusted dollars. And they're spending about 74% more than they were spending a generation ago.
I wanted to add a point about just a sort of a technical finance point. In the early 80s, when interest rates were very high, you had house prices that stagnated. Mm-hmm. As interest rates fell, even if you have exactly the same amount of demand, the people who are selling real estate can command a higher price because people can pay for a higher price. And so you have a lagged effect that housing prices rise lagged after interest rates falling. You have exactly the reciprocal response. When interest rates rise, you have housing prices stagnate. When interest rates rise, they stagnate. What we've got now is we've had a period where housing prices have gone up because it followed a long low interest rate period. And that's true for all assets, whether it's houses, whether it's portfolios of stocks. All those assets go up in value with a period of sustained low interest rates. The problem that we have that's catastrophic now, it's not a choice of whether you're living in a mobile home or a mansion, is that interest rates are going up and the rise in house prices are already high for most people to afford. They're going to stagnate. And we're going to have interest rates, and the people who are currently living at the edge will no longer be able to afford until 5 or 10 years later when house prices have declined. And in that time, they will lose their homes. So when we talk about predatory lending, it's hard to be in favor of that. When you say democratization of credit, it's hard to be against that. My question is, when you know that 30 to 40% of the borrowers who get their feet in quicksand in the subprime mortgage industry will eventually foreclose and lose their lifetime's equity, at what point do we say enough is enough?
Bob Samuelson, Newsweek. My question for Christian Weller, you did a good study on rising levels of debt, and you showed, as others have pointed out, that if you go back 30, 40, 50, 60 years, that there's just been an enormous expansion of consumer debt in relation to income. I think your figures begin in the early 1950s, but if you go back to the end of World War II, consumer debt as a percentage of personal income was 20 or 21%. It's now, I don't know, 115, 120%. I haven't done the arithmetic.
26.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, recently. So my question is, how much of that is families taking on higher debt levels, and why did they do it? And how much of it is families who were basically excluded from the debt market altogether joining it?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, the household data that we have from the Survey of Consumer Finance doesn't go back as far, so we only have till 1989. We definitely see both phenomena that you see more households with all forms of credit. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. There's 30 tables in the report that we just released. But I would say for the last few years, the phenomenon, especially in the middle class, is much more a phenomenon of taking on more debt for the households that were indebted than proliferation of bringing in more households. If you, for instance, look at mortgages, yes, home ownership rates are up, but the rate of home ownership growth has slowed down in the last few years. And you see this also in the debt numbers. So I think the last few years in particular are much more, especially the acceleration in outstanding credit, is much more a phenomenon of poor households taking on more debt relative to income than instead of more households having debt to begin with. We have time for one question.
I want to ask the panel to respond because I think the comment was made about consumers kind of having a choice about how much they lay out for mortgages. I'm wondering if the panel can address sort of the business models that we see today versus then what we see in the past in the mortgage lending industry where it's an incentive-based approach.
Could I just add a point about business models because I think it's a great question. Think about actually the very way that Mark Zandi described these interest-only mortgages. He described them as something marketed to people who can't afford to make a regular payment on a mortgage. They don't have enough money in the lowest possible interest rate environment to pay the interest on the money and a little tiny click toward principal. And remember, in most mortgages in the first few years, the click toward principal is very, very tiny indeed. That tells us that a profound business model shift has taken place. When there are people out pushing mortgages to folks that they know don't have the income to support anything more, and to say to these people, talk about bad advice that's been out there, don't worry, look how the market has been rising. Because you want to say to yourself, what have they been thinking? They say, don't worry, look how the market is rising. When you this thing gets ready to readjust in 2 years, your income's not going to be any higher, I understand that, but the value of the house will be up 25%. You'll either refinance, take out some cash to be able to make these higher mortgage payments, or you'll sell the house and you'll be a rich man and you'll go buy something more modest at that point. That tells us that mortgage brokers, we have created a new phenomenon. Instead of the lender on one end who looks across at the borrower and says, gee, I wonder if this guy's not only going to be able to pay today, but will be able to pay 6 months from now and 6 years from now, because if not, I'm stuck on this mortgage. Instead, with asset securitization, selling these things off to pools, we have three players. And the player in the middle, the mortgage broker, only makes money when the deal occurs. The fact that the deal may fall apart in 6 months or a year or in 3 years when interest rates readjust and nobody's income keeps up with that is just simply not the mortgage broker's problem. I think we have seen changes in the business model, in the credit card industry, in the payday loan industry. It's been one after another. But the consequence has been over and over and over toward consumers, get the deal done, sign on the bottom line, and what happens to you in 24 months? Don't worry your pretty head about it.
No, wait, we can't end there.
Yeah, we can.
One of the, I think, perhaps arguably the crowning achievements of the past, economic achievements of the past decade is the increase in home ownership. We've gone from a home ownership rate that's 64-63% in the early 90s to 69-70% today. That's a lot of households that have gone from renting to owning a home, and I think we can all agree that that is a very laudable event. And if you want to look at any economic statistic you can find, that is a statistic that is astounding. That's a statistic that historically has moved glacially. It has increased substantively over the last decade. And that is due to many forces, but one of the most important forces is the fact that lenders are creative, they are aggressive, and they work with borrowers in trying to figure out how to get them into a home. Now, yes, there are mistakes. People have made mistakes. Borrowers have made mistakes. Lenders have made mistakes. Yes, some lenders have been predatory. And yes, there will be a rise in delinquency, and yes, there will be a rise in default. But when the dust settles, the home ownership rate will be measurably higher at the end of it than it was at the beginning of this process, and we will all be measurably better off for it.
Well, I just say that's not the place to end either. First, the dust hasn't settled. We're just starting into the dust storm, and if it's your eyes that get blown out in the dust storm, we'll see how you feel about that. But the other part of it that you have to think about is when we talk about these products as having made it more affordable for people to buy homes, you know, there's another way to look at it. What happened with all of these innovative products that were hawked by the mortgage brokers is they are the ones who helped drive up the price of the homes themselves. So we made homes more unaffordable, especially in the last 3 years, in the run-up of these creative devices that kept propping up home values by making more and more people not only able to take on more home than they're going to be able to afford even over a five-year window, but in fact told them that they should be buying them, that only doofs weren't in the home ownership business because that was the way to become a millionaire in America. I think we created a real problem, and I think the folks who are principally responsible for it are in the mortgage industry. I don't think they're our friends.
Well, unfortunately, we have to end it here on that.
And I'm your friend, by the way.
And you all thought economics was dull and boring. All right. Thank you all to a fantastic panel, and we're looking forward to the next panel.
You're listening to material from a conference, Debt Matters, Raising the Profile of Household Debt in America, sponsored by the Center for American Progress, a Washington, D.C. think tank. The speakers were Christian Weller, moderator and senior economist at CAP, Martin Eakes, CEO of the Self-Help Credit Union and Center for Responsible Lending, Mark Zandi, Chief Economist from Moody's Economy.com, and Elizabeth Warren, Leo Gottlieb Professor of Law, Harvard Law School. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. Our final panel deals with public perceptions of household debt.
Well, good morning. My name is John Halpin. I'm a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. And on behalf of our partners in this research effort, the Center for Responsible Lending, National Military Family Association, and AARP, let me welcome you to this presentation of what we think is very fascinating, new, and important public opinion data about Americans' attitudes and beliefs about household debt. As you'll hear in a few minutes from Anna and Bill, Americans are quite concerned about rising household debt on things like mortgages, car loans, credit cards, school loans, other things like that. And as we heard in the first panel, they're particularly worried about unmanageable debt that's arising from external factors like unforeseen medical disasters, loss of employment, stagnant wages, rising utility costs. So what we've learned from this research and what we'll see in a few minutes here is that the issue of household debt is now clearly seen as a middle class issue. It is no longer seen as something that is plaguing the poor. It's now affecting a huge swath of Americans, and Americans are quite concerned about it. And as we heard factually in the first panel, Americans are very they're right and correct in being concerned about it. The facts are pretty stark. What we're trying to do with this research and follow-up briefings is to raise the saliency and public awareness, political awareness about the rising pressures of household debt, and a variety of policy proposals for how we can try to address this. the center and its partners were fortunate to have two very distinguished public opinion analysts to design and execute some survey research for us looking at American attitudes about debt. First, we have Anna Greenberg, who is a vice president and principal at Greenberg Quinlan Wozner Research, my old employer. Anna is an expert on U.S. politics and issues surrounding religion, gender, youth, and culture. The firm she works for is a leading Democratic progressive firm. We also have Bill McIntyre, who is a co-founder and partner at Public Opinion Strategies, a leading Republican firm based in Virginia. Many of you may know Bill from his work as co-director of the NBC News, Wall Street Journal National Poll, and his firm has executed many award-winning campaigns. We're very fortunate to have the two of them lead this project for us. And what I'd like to do is we're going to turn it over to Anna to present the data. Bill's going to offer some commentary. Let me first turn it over to Anna and welcome everybody and thank you for your work and
thank
all
you,
your
John.
Effort.
Thank you, John, and thank you to the Center and the partners in this project for involving me and Bill in this fascinating, interesting, and incredibly important project. I know that the previous panel, you had sort of a factual explanation for the rise in household debt. What we have today is actually a sort of a snapshot of how the American public views not just the problem of debt overall, but also in their own lives, and then a few potential policy solutions, which we can talk about more during Q&A. This was based on a national survey that we conducted among 1,000 adults 18 or over. It was conducted in April, a standard national survey. Let me start by talking about the issue of debt in terms of how serious people see this problem. When we ask people, is debt that comes from things like credit cards, car loans, home mortgages, payday loans, is that a very serious problem, somewhat serious, not too serious, or not a problem at all? We found that people overwhelmingly thought that the problem of household debt was a problem, 82%. But what I would ask you to look at is the intensity of the answer to this question, which is nearly half of people in the country think that the problem, the issue of household debt, I should say, is a very serious problem. And what you'll see throughout this survey is that there's an intensity to people's belief about household debt as a problem that is unifying really across income level, across race, across partisanship, and it's in some ways it's interesting that it's a kind of there's a consensus around this being a major problem in our country, but relatively little attention to it at the level of policy and politics. It is a problem that people universally believe is getting worse. We asked people in the past 5 years, do you think the number of Americans having trouble with household debt on things like credit cards, car loans, payday loans, home mortgage, has gone up, gone down, or stayed about the same? And you can see that 86% of people say it's gone up. Now, we know that's true from a kind of factual perspective. You learned that in the last panel. It is incredibly interesting to see that people know it's true in terms of perception. Obviously, some of it comes from their own problems they're having with household debt, probably with friends and family, and you know, probably just a general awareness, but it is an overwhelming result. Bill and I were both shocked to see 86%. We thought that people would think it was a problem. We didn't think that it would be that high, and then actually after the first night of calling, we added a follow-up to say, has it gone up a little or has it gone up a lot, and you still had a majority saying it's gone up a lot. So we believe this is a very robust result. Not only do people think this is a very serious problem, they think it's a problem that is shared collectively. We ask people, is this a problem for the middle class or is it primarily for people who are lower income? And what you can see, and we just define middle class as people earning over $50,000 a year, you can see that 80%, again, I mean, what's so interesting about these results is that on every single one of these questions, we get, you know, three quarters or higher of people saying it's a very serious problem, it's going up, it's affecting everyone. 80% say this is a problem that affects middle class families, which of course we know is factually true, but this is not a poor person's problem. Now, what we wanted to do was try and place the question of household debt in the context of the set of worries that people have about their lives. They worry about getting sick and getting cancer. They worry about terrorist attacks. They worry about retirement, about identity theft, about bankruptcy, a whole range of issues that people might have in their lives. And what you can see here on this chart is that concerns about debt fall somewhere in the middle of things that people worry about. People are more worried about identity theft and retirement if you look at the kind of total worried column and the very worried column. They're less worried about being victims of a terrorist attack or a natural disaster. And various aspects of debt, in particular medical expenses, and I'm going to pull that out in a minute to talk about that a little bit more, sort of fall in the middle of things that people are worried about. But what I'd say is that One of the things that we learned in this survey is different people struggle with different kinds of debt. So if you're younger, you're more likely to be dealing with student loans. If you are in middle age and have a family, you're more likely dealing with things around mortgage and home equity loans and car loans. If you're older, and especially in that 50 to 64 range, you're worrying about medical expenses. And so it is actually fairly difficult, because what we did in that earlier question was disaggregate different kinds of debt that people might be worried about. So when we said, okay, anybody who's worried about debt, let's figure that out. And it turns out that 62% overall worry about at least some aspect of household debt, and almost a third, you know, are very worried about it. So even though debt sort of falls in the middle of people's overall concerns, almost two-thirds, at least in some respects, worry about debt. And again, it's very dependent on sort of where your situation in life. Overall, it's not surprising that we see that the people who really are on the economic margins worry more about debt. There's an interesting dynamic going on in this survey. People who are better educated, who are married, who own homes, are more likely to carry debt. They carry larger amounts of debt. But they also are the people who are best able to deal with that debt, and they're the most likely to have what I call, for lack of a better way of describing it, good debt. Debt in the sense that it's an investment for the future. So, in other words, having a mortgage not only gives you the tax deduction, but it's an investment and your houses appreciate, and so it helps you over the long run. What you can see here is that the people who are most worried about debt tend to be people who are more economically marginal, so people who are younger, people who are unmarried, people who don't have a college education, people of color. And we find that they are less likely to have the good kind of debt and more likely to have the debt that from, you know, payday lenders, for example, though that kind of debt that's not necessarily kind of an investment for the future, the kinds of things that Derek and John have mentioned, but it's the kind of debt that actually can put you in real trouble in the long term. And so it's not surprising. And these numbers, they are significantly more worried. If you notice, the slide before was 27% very worried about some aspect of debt. We're looking at anywhere from 33 to almost 50% very worried about some aspect of debt. I want to just flag here that when it comes to debt, specifically the kinds of debt that is highest on the list is falling into debt because of medical expenses. We know, and I'm sure it was mentioned in the last panel, that the cost of health care has increased exponentially in recent years, and that we find that people, again, particularly in that middle, you know, sort of age range, because people who are seniors are covered by Medicare, but in that middle age range, that medical debt is their biggest worry, and it's a substantial portion of their debt. And I think we wanted to flag this because it seems to us to be a problem that is just going to get worse as healthcare costs continue to increase. So we asked people, what kind of debt are you carrying? And this is a difficult question because not many people want to admit, just like people want to say they vote and own library cards and don't do drugs or commit crimes, it's hard to get people to admit that they might have debt. And so we asked this question. And knowing that we would probably get people underreporting the amount of debt they actually carry. And what I want to point out about this question is that we asked this question exclusive of a mortgage. So we're asking people how much debt do they carry on credit cards, car loans, student loans, doctor and hospital bills, finance companies, home equity loans, educational loans. But prior to this question, we said exclusive of your mortgage. And what you can see is that a fifth admit to us on the phone that they're carrying over $20,000 worth of debt. A third are carrying over $10,000 worth of debt. This is I think this is a sort of stunning number. I mean, we know factually that the average American family is carrying $8,000 of credit card debt, but there are lots of other kinds of debt. And we're looking, I think, at some very serious numbers here. Just to give it a little more texture, the people who are most likely to be carrying debt are non-seniors. Okay, so if we looked at people under 65, we would see higher levels of debt that they're carrying. Non-seniors are the least likely. Seniors are less likely to carry debt. When we asked individuals, "Is your debt, has it gone up, has it gone down, or stayed the same over the last 5 years?" You can see here that a third report that their debt has gone up. A third has stayed the same, and 28 gone down. So, I mean, the modal responses are going up or staying the same. Clearly, people are not making great inroads in reducing the amount of household debt that they are carrying. So we wanted to know, where is this debt coming from? And what we find is there's a range of reasons, and again, it's very much dependent on where you are in the life cycle, where you are economically, whether or not you're married. I mean, there are lots of aspects to people's lives that impact the kind of debt that they take on. But what we find is there are voluntary reasons for debt, and then involuntary reasons for debt. And not everything that is voluntary really is voluntary. I mean, if you need to drive to get to a job and you have to have a car and you don't have the cash, you take out a car loan and so you have a car loan. But at any rate, these are items in the kind of general category of people opt to take on this kind of debt. And so you can see there's car loans, college loans, you know, poor spending habit, not being good at budgeting, etc. What you find, though, is that people are more likely to report these involuntary reasons for debt. And this, again, I think meshes very well with the previous presentation, which sort of talked about the cost of living and how the cost of living has increased relative to wages and salaries. And what you can see here is that people are, in essence, saying, you know, the cost of living is so high that I have to take on debt in order to meet my basic expenses. And so whether it's prices increasing, energy costs, childcare, medical costs, people are citing these kinds of involuntary reasons for debt. So we asked, who do you think is responsible for this problem? This has very important policy implications. Part of what we explored, and granted, you know, we would like to do everything in a survey and you can't, but part of what we wanted to explore was who do you blame as partially a way to get into what are some possible solutions to the issue. And what we found was that, and there's a strong strand of this throughout the survey, so I want to make this very clear, people do believe that individuals have responsibility for managing their own finances. People do believe that people make poor decisions in budgeting and spending. And I think it would be foolhardy for anybody who cares about this issue to ignore the fact that there is a level of individual responsibility in taking on household debt and that people believe that individuals have responsibility. And so what you can see here in this forced choice question, a third of people basically think individual borrowers are responsible for their debt. But we have a range of other responses that are important. The economy, and by the economy, even though we didn't ask people to explain what they mean by the economy, I think it's fairly clear from the other results of this survey that it's about the cost of living. It's about not being able to keep up with prices. The government, part of that may be taxes. Lenders and lending institutions, it's interesting. People do not, at least in this context, really blame lenders and lending institutions. It is not that people have a favorable view of them, and I think the entire survey will be available to people, and you'll be able to see we did a battery on favorability towards credit card companies and payday lenders and those kinds of organizations, and they are viewed very negatively. Banks are viewed positively, credit unions positively, but credit card companies, payday lenders, viewed very negatively. So it's not that people think that these kinds of lenders are wonderful actors in all this, but they tend to not blame them. And part of what I think this effort is about, to some degree, is to figure out how you educate people about the practices that lenders engage in. In fact, we have a part of the survey that we called the scary facts section of the survey, where we actually introduce some information to respondents about bankruptcy rates and other things. And when we introduce some information about some of the practices that lenders engage in, like universal default by credit card companies, people, not surprisingly, are quite appalled by those kinds of lending practices, and people are quite supportive of dealing with better regulation of lending practices. But I think it is important just to note that, you know, at the outset, lenders and lending institutions are not seen as much as part of the problem as the economy and individuals themselves. So we did some work, and we didn't, unfortunately, just because of time, didn't really spend as much time as we all would have liked to on thinking about what are some policy solutions to the debt problems that we know factually people are facing and that Americans themselves know that others and themselves are facing. And what you can see is that, first, there is a fair amount of emphasis on helping individuals be better at dealing with their household finances. So whether it's providing incentives for people to save money, for example, tax credits that you get for saving for retirement, or, you know, tax credits for saving for college education, but providing some kind of incentive to make it easier for people to save, but also somehow making sure that people are better educated about lending practices. So you can see the second column on here is creating stronger requirements that companies explain their charges in simple, uncomplicated language. There's a recognition that often the way lenders describe what they're doing is incomprehensible to people. How many of you just sign things without reading them? I know I do. So that, you know, making sure that people understand better what it is they're getting into when they take on certain kinds of debt. There is absolute support for cracking down on abusive lending practices. But finally, and this is a much bigger issue than I think that, you know, any one individual organization can deal with, but dealing with the cost of living. I mean, there's a reality that the cost of living is making it very difficult. I mean, again, as the previous panel pointed out, the people just simply don't have cash, and they need to take on debt in order to have cash, but dealing with how much healthcare costs, how much housing costs, how much it costs to get an education. The final thing I would say before turning it over to Bill is that, you know, we're in an incredibly polarized political environment. There's very little that either of the parties agree on, and certainly in the context of electoral campaign, it's even worse. What's interesting and I think really important about the debt issue is this is one where there's fairly universal agreement about household debt being a problem, that it's something, and that it's something that we need to do something about, and that there are a variety of policies that we all can agree on to try and do something about the debt problem. So if you look at this slide here, we took the same policy solutions that we tested in the just overall and broke it out by partisanship, by education level, and you can see that there are very minor differences. Just as an example, to take the top line, providing more incentives for people to save money, 93% of both Republicans and Democrats agree we should provide incentives for people to save money. Now, of course, that's an easy thing to agree on. But again, if you go down this entire list of policy proposals, you'll see there's almost no daylight between Democrats and Republicans, nor are there gender differences. And so I think in some ways, for people who care about this issue, politically we have a unique opportunity because we have an issue where, one, people are aware of the problem and think it's a serious problem. Two, they know that debt has gone up. Three, for a lot of people, their own personal debt has gone up or has remained unchanged, so they're not really able to get out of it. And I can't remember if I was on ABC or 123. D, you know, we have relatively uniform agreement on a set of policy solutions to do something about it. So I think that this is an incredibly important project, this entire conference, because just looking at the slice of public opinion data, I think that we're at a critical moment where there's near universal agreement that this is a problem we should do something about. So I'm going to turn it over to Bill for his color commentary.
Thank you. I'm going to try to be very brief because I think Anna did a great job trying to kind of walk through some major observations from a lot of data we collected. What I'd like to do is to say, what did I get to learn from doing this project? That's why my job is so fun, because I do so many different things. What did I learn? What did I take away from this that surprised me that I would like to remember? And from that, I'd like to start with that figure, which is 86% said they think that for most Americans over 5 years that their credit card and their debt has gone up. Why is that surprising? Because the way as a pollster we asked that question, we said, did things go up? Did they go down or did they stay the same? And on most surveys, when you say stay the same, it's at least 15 or 25%. In other words, that kind of status quo option, which is okay, nothing much has changed, it's at least that percent. So when we wrote this question, I said, this will be high, okay, it'll be interesting, it's 60%, 65. I don't think, if you ask me, just kind of do as a test, like what would I feel, and what do I think Americans are going to say? And by the way, that's how we actually interview them and not just make up data. Because, despite how many years I'm doing this, they tend to surprise me. Because they said 86, and they kind of ignored the stay the same. And so to get some more use from the data, we kind of, in the last few days, snuck in a question saying, well, how much more, a lot or some? And a majority said a lot. And it is a way, I think, that kind of captures the problem. Number two. As pollsters, I can tell you from a press inquiry, what are the press questions I get? I get all these questions saying, gee, there are so many macro indicators, the economy is in good shape, why don't people believe it? What's the gap? And what this survey does, if there's a macro economy, there's a micro economy. It is our individual lives. And this survey really gives you a pretty nice and profound sense of those individual lives. And what did they tell us? What do we learn? First, that roughly 1 out of 4 people say that frequently or sometimes they cannot pay their bills every month. Now, 25% sounds like a little number, but that's 60 million adults. That's a huge chunk of the country. So if you're one of those 60 million adults who can't, frequently or sometimes cannot finish paying your bills because you have no cash, how would you be affected because the stock market's gone up? The unemployment rate's down, personal income growth is up. In your life, you can't pay. You are having struggles to pay a monthly bill. And in that regard as well, again, I do so much healthcare work, but underlying what people worry about and what's in this survey is the dimension of how much they worry and are concerned about healthcare costs. And that medical expenses and healthcare is kind of a wild factor that puts a lot of people, and when Anna talks about people who are at the margins economically, lower income folks, people of color, less well educated, single folks, younger people, believe me, these are folks who in our culture and our workplace don't have stable health coverage either. And so there's a relationship, I think, between why these are concerns and the people who are most concerned. And then lastly, or connected to that, kind of why is there this gap between why, quote, the economy is in such good shape and, quote, people don't see it? It's that, in fact, people are telling us that this is a middle class issue, that this is not somehow restricted to those folks at the economic margin, that this has become a pervasive issue. Now, point three. Anna's firm, as a Democrat firm, has done real breakthrough work research in this, but it is something I think I contribute, having been as a Republican in 25 years in that side of the aisle and 15 or 18 years as a pollster, is the theme of personal responsibility. And what I keep telling folks over and over and over again, whether it be welfare or education or, you know, people in this country expect people to do and do as much as they can to help and take care of themselves. And we are a generous country that want to help people in need, but we want to see that people are helping themselves. And so in this data, when you give people the chance and you say, who's really to blame for this? To me, it's not surprising that if you give people a chance to say people are, because they make bad decisions and they're not, you know, they should be held accountable for those bad decisions. That in public policy you can't protect people from bad decisions, and you have to in fact say that we're not going to supplant or make sure we're not going to supplant the fact people should be responsible for themselves. And when we talk about party, I want to make again, what's a stable difference in attitudes between Republicans and Democrats in this country? That issue of personal responsibility. That in that data point, 54% of Republicans said individuals have to be held accountable. That's the that's who's most to blame. Only 23% of Democrats did. And so I think it's really powerful when Anna showed you how those kind of thematic statements about what we needed to resolve this were not very different by party. But it tells you that if you're going to sell a solution and you're going to make it politically sellable, that some of that solution is making sure that rhetorically you don't kind of trip that wire, people saying, what are you talking about? You can't, you know, people got to take care of themselves. The second thing I would say in general is I believe, you know, as an observation, there are two or three great issues that our political culture has undervalued and that there's a political positioning that exists that is underutilized and not yet exploited. And exploited, I don't mean as pejorative. I mean to take advantage of the public mood. Let me just go through them quickly, just because it's an interesting perspective. I like it. One, I think our country's far more willing to do much more aggressive stuff in healthcare reform than politicians think. This is a country really frustrated by our healthcare system. Two, there is an enormous opening on the topic of re-education and job training about how do we prepare and keep track in the next 20, 30 years. And three, this whole issue of pension and retirement, savings and security are all wrapped together. That unfortunately is true because they're seeing so many corporations bag out on their pension obligations and have those kind of troubles. But what I'm suggesting is that when President Bush started his let's talk about private retirement accounts, I think that the right solution here is to go bigger. People do worry about Social Security, but in general, this broad umbrella about how do I save for the future, how do I know my pension is secure, how do we fix Social Security, that umbrella message about savings, retirement, security is really powerful and really of concern to people, and that in the political culture, our candidates have not yet gotten right how to talk about that and make that connective tissue to people to have them see those links. And that what this survey taught me is that there is an entryway there to make it not just for balding people over 50 with, you know, glasses and, you know, saying, I better start thinking about that long-term stuff. That there's a way to make that connective tissue to people across generations and ages, because there, when Anna talks about the different stages of personal debt, that there are different ways to engage that broad conversation amongst a very broad electorate. Now, did this survey exactly tell us how to do that? No. But that's what I'm saying is those two or three big positionings for those of us who are looking ahead to 2008 or longer term, how do we talk about policy issues? Those are two or three things, huge things that I think are sitting out there that would engage the public in a way that would be dramatic and impactful that our political culture underrepresents. And I see the threads of that in this data, and I see the threads of that to how to do that connective tissue better across that broad savings, retirement, pension, and security theme. And so, that's those two or three things have been of real interest to me. I've been saying this. I hope to make some progress in with some people to help figure out how we would address them and talk about it. That's what I want to do in 2008. But it's a kind of a preview data of kind of what's out there that people want to talk about that we undervalue. And so obviously, the people in this room are different. Because we have a lot of folks in the room spending a day talking about debt as a political issue, and I think it's fair to say that this survey shows people how to talk about it and get into the issue, but you're a little far ahead of the curve. But that's, by the way, a pretty safe place to be in America, because America catches up with the curve pretty quickly. And so with that, we look forward to comparing notes and questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Anna and Bill. Really appreciated your presentation. If I could execute my role as moderator for a second here, there's something that I've been trying to figure out through all this data, and I think you raised it, you both raised it, on the issue of individual responsibility. Is it actually possible, in your opinion, to turn household debt into a social concern rather than an individual one? And, you know, there's so much primacy on the individual throughout this poll, and, you know, it's common sense in many ways. It fits with longstanding sort of American ethic. The other part that's interesting is that, you know, there's basic human psychology here, and I think it's generational. As someone mentioned on the first panel, for older generations, debt's probably fairly still embarrassing in a way. Nobody mm-hmm. likes to admit to holding lots of debt or being in over their head on finances. For younger generations who are, you know, have school loans, debt's a way of life. So they're kind of nonplussed about it, even though they may be upset and all that. But nobody's really clamoring for any change here from the public. So we see concern. No one's really there's no real uprising from the public to do something about this. Is it possible to turn an issue like household debt into a social political concern, or is that likely not to happen in your estimation?
Just real quickly, I think it's hard to do. I think it's hard to do unless you connect it to those bigger issues. And then three, I think that one of the things you should learn about healthcare is that part of it is because people didn't know the political system could address it. And so a lot of times, like prescription drugs for seniors, no one talked about in the 90s. As soon as people started saying, you know, we can make it cheaper for seniors, that became a huge political issue. HMO reform in 98. People were really, really ticked off in 96 about HMOs. Their faith on faith were plummeting. It wasn't a political issue until the political culture said, oh, by the way, we could fix that. So the point I want to make is I've got tons of examples of issues where people had data like this, it wasn't being talked about, and then the minute somebody did and it worked, and people said, yeah, I really care about that, the culture changes very quickly to address those issues. And part of what it makes is a political translation. And like Senator Wofford in 91 in that special election about health care, it was an undervalued piece of property that someone finally found a powerful way to communicate to people, and it changed our political culture. And so when I went through those two or three things that are intriguing to me that I think have the potential to change our political culture, I'm kind of serious that it's been a delivery vehicle problem of explaining to people that there's something we can do and that the political and our political system could address that. And I don't think a lot of people kind of say, oh, my gosh, Congress could do something about that. Our political leaders could do something about that. They think of it in this kind of personal umbrella and not under something Congress or the political system could respond to. And that's and so it's a little bit of chicken and egg in which it goes first, but I think it's really clear to me that what goes first is somebody smart in politics saying, oh, I got it, here's what people care about, and I can bundle it in a way that explains to people we can do something about that. And as soon as they hear it, they kind of glom onto it.
I agree, and I think the follow-up point I would make is that connecting these issues to the macro economy, if you will, is part of individuals understanding that they're part of a bigger problem and that they're not always personally responsible, but in fact the reason they're in trouble is because of what's going on in the economy. But the other thing I would say is I think it's always a mistake to try to, and I'm not suggesting you're saying this, John, but to ignore the core American values that Americans hold. And individualism and individual responsibility and pull yourself up your bootstraps is a core American value, and I think it's a mistake to ignore that. I think sometimes progressives want to not deal with that issue. I think, if you take questions of education reform, it's very hard for progressives to deal with the fact that a lot of people think that parents are responsible for what happens with their kids in school as much as schools are responsible, and we tend to not really want to deal with the issue of individual parental responsibility with their children. So I would say that rather than try to find a way, I think there is a way, as Bill said, that to sort of grab this piece of political property and communicate in a way that helps people understand that there is a larger problem going on, that there is a solution, that they're part of it. But I think it's a mistake and to sort of ignore the beliefs that people have about individual responsibility. And I think that we can talk about empowering people to make better decisions by dealing with what lenders do. And there's a whole variety of ways that we can empower people to make sure they have the right tools to make the right kinds of decisions. And there's a whole range of different kinds of education for people that you could imagine would help. But again, I think when we try to push back against the core American values people hold, we often lose.
Thank you. I wasn't suggesting that. It's a good point. And it's one thing we've been trying to work on is how you would sort of frame an overall policy approach. And I think some of your data is very helpful in this. You use some of the words here: education, empowerment, protection, and responsibility. Those are the four elements that sort of come to my mind through some of your language and some other language as a way to describe what we're trying to do. I'd like to turn it over to some questions for Anna and Bill. If you wouldn't mind just stating your name and who you're with or what you do, that would be helpful.
Thanks. Adam Scheffler. I'm an independent health policy analyst from Chicago. I had a factual question. One is, what was the breakdown of Democrats and Republicans polled out of the 1,000? Was it roughly equal or is it?
It's reflective of it's a nationally representative sample, so it's reflective of kind of the national numbers, which is slightly more Democratic. And I just want to get the summary numbers here. It's 38% Democratic, 29% Independent, 29% Republican.
Okay. And the other thing about personal responsibility, not to contradict any of the points that were made, but personal responsibility in a context, I think, is part of the framing that you're going for. You know, institutions also have responsibility, and we need to talk about, you know, institutional malfeasance with managing the economy so that people can exercise their responsibility in an appropriate way. You know, individual responsibility doesn't exist in a vacuum, I guess is the point I would make to those who are trying to frame a policy message and a policy response.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a comment. What I'm describing is whether people will listen to your policy idea, and because of on this immigration stuff, just as an example, when you start talking about the long range solution and you're in the middle of the Senate bill, it's almost sequential for not everybody in this room, but for a majority of Americans, what they say is, one, you can't have millions of people coming across your border illegally. You got to control the border. Two, we have to make sure there's sanctions on employers. And if they hear those two things I can tell you, about 70% of Americans would go, that makes sense, And then if you say, and if we do those two things, we have to deal with the fact that we have a long-range problem, here's what I would do. But when you jump in the long-range problem on this issue, when you haven't said those first two things, people are saying, what are they talking about? How can we have a long-range solution when millions of people are coming across our border? And what I'm suggesting is rhetorically on this and other issues, this is why we're both saying the personal responsibility thing, if you say, look, people have a responsibility to make sure they make good decisions in their own life and don't make bad financial decisions. We need to help them. And we need to make sure that others don't take advantage of people who have less skills, et cetera, et cetera. But when you start the conversation like that, about 90% of the people in the room will say, that makes sense to me. I believe that. But when you start in the middle of, here's what government should do to make sure these people get penalized, the rest of people are saying, but what about those? But people have an obligation themselves. And so we're not disagreeing. I'm just saying rhetorically, and what Anna was saying specifically from her perspective as to quote progressives, is they don't understand that for about 90% of our country, they need to hear the first clip first before they'll listen to what else needs to get done to fix it, because then they're comfortable. You understand my frame of reference to how I believe people need to run their lives. And so I'm using the immigration sample as maybe a bad to just say you have to start people with something they believe that fits their value frame that connects with where they're at to get them to where you want to go. And a lot of times in public policy, people jump in the solution without the connective tissue to allow people to come with you because they say that person understands my values and they understand the way I would approach that problem from a value perspective. And so that's what I believe, well, I don't want to speak to Anna. That's what I'm trying to indicate when I talk about this, that on this issue, you've got to tell people, you understand people have to be held accountable for their own, for financial, for what they've done. They've got to make good decisions, and we have to help them. And we can help people do that better. And if we were doing kind of what we do sometimes with dials, we have like this many swing voters and then watching stuff. If we did two clips, one clip is starting with a values frame I've just said, they would go like this, they'd be through the roof and the dial, and when they got to the rest of the stuff, it would test higher. If you cut that beginning and you cut to what you want as a solution, there'd be a lot of people saying, gosh, I don't know, what about people's responsibility? And they wouldn't be, and we would, if we were doing this for this client or others, you could see this incredibly powerful difference by how, under what frame you were trying to present that data.
My name is Kirsten Keefe. I'm with Americans for Fairness in Lending. We're a message campaign trying to raise awareness of these issues. My question is, did you do any polling about Americans' awareness that the laws are different now than they were in the beginning of the 80s and that things have changed and that a lot of protections that used to exist in our parents' time don't exist, such as usury caps and the like? I find a lot of people think that there still are usury caps and that the government still is watching our back. Did you do any polling specifically on that, or do you have any sense of that?
We didn't explore that in this survey. I suspect that people have absolutely no understanding of what the laws are around lending, especially younger people. I mean, I say that just from my gut. But given how little people know generally about complicated policy areas, I would suspect that people don't know very much. And in fact, when we did in the later part of the survey, we started testing some of the issues around lending practices. There was some shock, I think, among our respondents about things like universal default. So I suspect people are not that aware of sort of the existing state of the law or even that it's changed since the 1980s.
Kathleen Keyes from the Center for Responsible Lending. I have a question for Bill. I see by your bio that you were involved in the Harry and Louise advertising campaign in response to the health care concerns of the early 90s. And one of the things that I find is very frustrating is that a lot of the changes in attitude that seem perfectly sensible responses are ones that we have trouble getting the financial services industry to think of in any way other than a knee-jerk, ideological, negative reaction to. And so any public policy campaign, particularly given the political power that the financial services industry has, seems to me that it can't be in opposition to them, no matter how many of the ordinary folks getting polled go along with this. And do you have any suggestions as to how to bring along the financial services industry to neutralize opposition to the most common sense kinds of reforms?
First, I want to just, I guess, somewhat, I think the premise is true. Here's one important premise. I've done a lot of work, for example, on Medicare reform. And on Medicare reform, one of the reasons we've had so much trouble doing it is because no one of the financial interest is really for it. You can't raise, millions of dollars to go on the air from funded by the players to try to change Medicare because all of those players have done okay under the current Medicare system. And so the notion that it's very hard to get actual change in this area because you have very, 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 powerful interests who have tons of money don't want change, I'm sorry, in our political culture that premise is true. And what it means, and this is very hard for activists or for people committed to an issue, is it means that you're not arguably going to get what you want. You have to be, both sides have to get something that is a stretch for both sides. And it's very hard to work under that accommodation. And I did spend, for example, in the Harry and Louise time, I was doing one or two healthcare speeches a week, tons of them with advocacy groups. And I was saying, like my client, the Health Insurance Association of America, they're the one major business interest who supports an employer mandate. No one else supports an employer mandate in the business community. They do. And like on the uninsured, I'm sorry, a lot of it, I do tons of work on this issue. You're not, the uninsured in this country, I hope to God we get them covered. I've worked very hard to make sure they get them covered. They're not going to have the same health care I have. They're going to have, if you want a sustainable policy, they're going to have very minimal coverage. But very minimal coverage that would cover preventive care and catastrophic cost would be a ton better for 45 million people than no coverage. But in the advocacy community, their fight is to make sure they have, like, fat, you know, great health care. And they don't want to compromise. And as a consequence, we get to nothing's going to change. And so the real answer to your question is, you're entirely right that they are, that there's tons of very expensive interest to have tons of influence. And it means the advocacy community, in all cases, is not going to get what they want. They're going to get some blend of what they can sustain. And then point three is, let me tell you the other part of political reality, like the drug companies, or like the health insurance industry. HIA adopted an employer mandate because Clinton got elected. They want tons further than they were willing to do before Clinton's election. There's also no question why our political culture exists, because guess what? With enough public pressure, the politicians go back to those interests and say, I can't sustain this anymore. There's too much pressure on me. I can't sustain your position. You're going to have to move a hell of a lot further. And so in a little bit of a chicken and the egg, I would also say I've done, you know, 15 years of work like this where tons of special interest groups have moved tons further than they ever thought they would 2 years earlier because of public pressure. Let me give my last example in that. The American Beverage Association 2 years ago said that as a policy they thought they should have, you know, they should have sodas in every school in the country. They have this vending machine, blah blah blah. Within a year and a half, all this stuff's gone in elementary and junior high schools, and only diet products in high schools in a year and a half. That's in a year and a half earlier. They said we would never compromise our right to sell a legal product to kids. Blah blah blah. Year and a half. They voluntarily pulled the stuff out of schools except for diets in high school. What happened? What happened is a very, very powerful interest met a very powerful force, which is tons of consumers saying, I'm sorry, our kids are having troubles with obesity. Why would we feed them this? Why would they have access to this stuff? And so so that's why I'm saying, so you do have the ability to use and change political issues in a way that changes those powerful interests to force them to compromise. But in general, I spend a lot of time with advocacy groups on the right to say, I'm sorry, you have to understand, you have this pristine position. Our culture works because we end up in some very mucky middle that is not what you want and doesn't make anybody happy. And about the time nobody's happy is about the time we get something done. And the really, really sophisticated, and I'll tell you my inspirational story. I did the first work for Cato to create private retirement accounts. The Cato position was we should junk Social Security and just have a private system. And I can tell you from the data, that's crazy. You know, no one in this country believes that. And so I said, that's crazy. And what he said is, Bill, I'm not a member of Congress. We're not the middle ground. We're the advocacy group. We're the nut jobs. We're the people who are supposed to be so extreme that when we drag our culture, that 2% will look like the middle ground. And so, but the point is, they could articulate that they were being deliberately provocative because they understood that at the end of the day, what they were going to get maybe was the umbrella's nose under the tent with 2%. And that's a pretty sophisticated interest group. And so I'm saying I'd work with lots of interest groups who are so committed to their cause that they don't understand that their cause is going to be mushed to something much more sustainable in our culture. I do believe, not to be provocative, I do believe that a lot of the healthcare groups have made minimal progress because they are unwilling to compromise on what will have to happen to get people in this country coverage or other issues. Thank you.
Anna Greenberg and Bill McInturf, pollsters and political consultants, speaking on public perceptions of household debt at a conference, Debt Matters, Raising the Profile of Household Debt in America, sponsored by the Center for American Progress last July. More of the conference can be viewed at AmericanProgress.org. And this and all previous shows can be downloaded at unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening. Come down.